This is Radio 4. Now, with new research on how society works, is Thinking Aloud, presented by Laurie Taylor.
And what's more, we Conservatives believe in popular capitalism, believe in a property-owning democracy, and it works. Millions have already become shareholders, and soon there'll be opportunities for millions more in British Gas, British Airways, British Airports, and Rolls-Royce. Who says we've run out of steam? We're in our prime. Popular capitalism is nothing less than a crusade to enfranchise the many in the economic life of the nation. We Conservatives are returning power to the people. That is the way to one nation, one people.
Good heavens, whatever happened to confrontational politics? Margaret Thatcher extolling the virtues of private share ownership at the Conservative Party conference in October 1986. Well, and her injunction was moderately successful. In 1979, only 7% of the UK population owned shares, and by the time Maggie tearfully departed in 1990, that figure had risen to 25%, but today it's fallen to round about 20%, with the vast majority in that percentage holding only a few shares, which are very rarely traded. And that does look pretty small beer compared to the position in the United States, where the huge growth of investment clubs from the 1990s onwards led to the regular participation of about 20 million people in stock market trading. The rise and rise of these investment clubs allowed the New York Times to refer to it as a shareholder democracy. But until now, there's been no comprehensive study of the nature of these clubs, the nature of their membership, their relative success at investment, their response to success and failure. Well, that omission has now been very successfully remedied in a new book by sociologist Brooke Harrington, a researcher at the Max Planck Institute for the Study of Societies. It's a book called Pop Finance, Investment Clubs and the New Investor Populism. And Brooke Harrington now joins me in the studio. Going back to those 1990s, when this was when we saw the big growth in these investment clubs, what was it about the social and economic conditions of the time which prompted their formation?
Well, really three things, one of which is closely related to your previous topic. I like how we've moved from sex to money and talk about intertwined desire and disgust. On the one hand, there is definitely an element of class aspiration and fantasy about it. And the opportunity was there to make a lot of money in the stock market. And as Americans, if not all people, have done historically, They jumped at the opportunity to have their piece of it.
And it was also a time, wasn't it, when in terms of pensions, there were being attacks made upon pensions. They couldn't count on their pensions. Their wages were falling as well. There were a number of increased anxieties around for them.
I think America has always had less of a social safety net than the UK or Europe has had. But things really began to get extreme starting in the 70s, when more and more employers stopped offering any sort of pensions at all, or they shifted all the burden and risk of having a pension in your old age onto you, the worker. So you had to decide how much of your income to put aside and how to invest it. And the company would, if they were particularly generous, might match the amount that you put in. And they would give you a menu of options to invest in. But even that was so far beyond the investment knowledge of most people that most people just simply never took advantage.
So how does or how did a typical investment club form? How does it get together in the first place?
There are two main routes. One was that the club would get together out of an existing group of friends, social contacts, basically. They could be neighbors. They could be people who were part of other voluntary activities. And then there was another set that got together because they met up through work or through school.
And they were usually, what size was a typical club?
Around about 15 people was an average, although you could see much smaller and much larger.
And they'd come together about once a month, something like that?
On average, yes.
And they'd put in a certain amount of money, an agreed amount of money, and then they'd sit down and work out how to invest the money. Now, tell me a little bit, because you observed, you looked at the ways in which they went about making these decisions. Tell me something about the process of deciding where to invest.
So imagine yourself in a group of 15 people, and you've each put in, say, $50 for the month. And now you've got to decide what to do with that money, because there's really no point in participating in a group like this if you're just going to plunk down your $50 and, you know, throw around pictures of your grandchildren and talk about your last vacation. You have to do something with it. So typically what would happen is someone would have been assigned in the previous meeting to make a presentation on this or that stock, or perhaps a sector of the economy like transportation. They would then come in and say, here's a stock, or here are a few stocks that we might consider as a club. They'd make their case, and then there would be a vote. Usually a hand.
It's interesting that it's something like, when you, for example, shall we invest in Harley Davidson, for example?
Yes.
Tell me about that. This throws up all sorts of odd disagreements, doesn't it?
One of the most successful groups I observed, and parenthetically, I should say, the reason I bothered to observe these clubs was that no one had ever studied them before. So before I could take another step, I needed to know what actually happened in them. So I spent a year with seven investment clubs. And this one club was composed of women who were all professionals, and they had been very successful, among the most successful investment clubs in the United States. And they had decided at the previous meeting that they
should... What was the name of this group, by the way? It had rather a nice name, didn't it? What was it called? Was it called Ladies with Leverage? Was this that club? I can remember. There's some lovely names of these clubs. Doesn't matter if you can't remember it. Stop, forgive me for interrupting you. Do go on.
I believe it was Asset Accumulator.
Asset Accumulator, okay.
They all have interesting punning names that range from just groaners to actually adorable. That's a whole other study in itself. But this particular group had decided at the previous meeting that they should invest within the leisure sector. And so they were considering a number of options. They'd narrowed it down from hundreds to two or three. And one of them was Harley Davidson. And they went through this sort of two-step process, as all the successful investment clubs I observed did. First, they talked about the financials. And they compared the various options that they'd discovered within leisure. Harley Davidson, I believe one was like Harrah's, the gaming company, or politely called gaming. And the financials looked particularly good for Harley Davidson. But then they had to decide, well, what is the implication of our throwing our money behind Harley Davidson, even though our contribution as a club is minuscule in the larger picture of Harley Davidson's finances? The discussion essentially turned to, is this the sort of company with which we wish to be identified? And one woman raised her hand and said, well, this is all very well in terms of profit-making opportunity, but honestly, would you want your husband or your son riding around on one of these things? And it was like the giant bucket of cold water just dumped over the group. And
is this because of these elements which come in that make these investments? Because I think they are relatively unsuccessful compared to other, say, private investors operating outside the clubs, aren't they? Is it possible to compare investment clubs with other forms of investment?
Oh, absolutely. They're intended to be a means to teach people in a fairly low cost and quick way how to be their own investment manager, so they're not paying commissions or paying a broker to invest for them. I would not say, though, that it's clear that they do substantially worse than the professionals.
It's not.
In fact, if you follow the fate of professional investment managers, it's a bit like watching sausage being made. It would put you off the whole endeavor.
But there are, which you did find, that some groups, the composition of some groups, did predict success rather better than others.
Absolutely. The groups that were more diverse, and especially in terms of gender, made more money consistently, and this was not just 1 year, but it was over 12 years.
Do you have a theory about why?
Oh, yes. That's basically the middle three chapters of the book. And the essence of it is really two things, one of which is that in any kind of complex task, like investing in the stock market, the more information you have to draw from in making your decisions, the better quality decision you're going to make. But in addition, in groups that were more diverse in terms of gender, they tended not to get along as well socially. And while that might seem like a disadvantage and was often perceived by the participants as a disadvantage, it was great for their decision-making quality because they were able to prioritize their money-making task over their social bonds.
And you say, one interesting thing that you make, the point that you make about this, is that this is in a way a sort of training for citizenship. Mm. Because you refer to, I mean, we had a variety of books recently talking about the lack of associations in America. I mean,
yes.
Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, for
yes.
example. But here you see this as, in a way, perhaps making up for the lack of involvement of Americans in other forms of civic association.
One of the things that gets lost in discussions of Putnam's book, and I'm not sure if many readers of his work realize it, but his measure of civic engagement is really outdated, I think. He's looking at membership in what used to be called fraternal organizations. They're not always single sex now, but things like the Elks Club and the Lions, things my grandfathers belonged to.
I want to ask you, though, just as a last question, what happened when the boom was over, when there was failure? Are these clubs still going? Has there been a decline in the number of such clubs? Are the reduced economic circumstances we now face mean the death of many of them?
Yes, but to a smaller extent than I would have expected. I did go back after my initial data gathering in the late 1990s. I went back in 2004 to find the same groups that I had studied 6 years previously, and I expected none of them to be still operating, but four of the seven still were. And part of that is just the inertia that comes from long association. Part of it is this sort of diehard belief in the market that may or may not be a case of American exceptionalism.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Now you give a lovely account of the way they still go on believing. Perhaps that is an American exceptionalism. Brooke Harrington, thank you very much. You're giving a lecture tomorrow, lunchtime, 1 o'clock, the RSA on this, aren't you?
Yeah.
Mustache now. I've got to have my knuckles tattooed with love and hate, get into my Reebok trainers, Adidas trackies, Burberry baseball cap, slip on my fat girl's sovereign ring. Honestly, these Radio 4 controller parties are an absolute menace.
I plan being on tomorrow, time, so I saw nothing thing, except that Thinking Aloud was presented by Laurie Taylor. The producer is Charlie Taylor. And you can sign up for the Thinking Aloud podcast at the Radio 4 website.